Although the United States is currently fighting at least one declared war and is involved in numerous proxy wars in the Middle East, many Americans remain shockingly misinformed about the region. To address that problem, Melissa Rossi has written a new book called What Every American Should Know About the Middle East, a kind of Middle East for Dummies. It's part of a series she's been publishing with Plume, and it brings Ms. Rossi to the show now. Welcome.
Hi, Leonard.
In the introduction to your book, you write that when you told your American friends that you were traveling to the Middle East, they recommended that you take a life insurance policy and even ask if you'd be wearing a burqa. Is it your friends, or do you think that those stereotypes about the region's security problems and its conservative social norms are typical?
Oh, I think that's very typical. I think Americans, we have an image of the Middle East as being nothing but a war zone filled with screaming Arab, Muslim, Islamists who are going to blow themselves up in front of us. There are some problem areas in the Middle East, obviously. The Palestinian territories are two of them, Gaza being one of those territories, and Iraq. They're pretty violent, pretty heated. However, most of the region is peaceful, and it's gorgeous, and it's filled with history, and it's a great tourist destination, actually.
So you're really calling for a more nuanced knowledge of the area. And since the Middle East is intimately connected with the United States politically and economically, why do you think that we know so little about it?
Well, I think it goes back to our schools. You know, we don't get history in our schools, especially outside of our country. So I think we need to really reexamine our curriculum and start looking at world history, particularly this area, because we're so linked to it. We're putting so much money into it. We're dependent on it for energy, and we're politically in arms deals, all kinds of ways we're linked to it.
Well, we have seen even American politicians kind of ignorant during the campaign, early in the campaign. John McCain didn't seem to know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, and I think President Bush had similar problems when he took office. So this is not just the American public. This actually goes to the higher levels. I don't know how much Barack Obama knows about the Middle East.
I think he's probably much better informed. I'm certainly hoping he is. Well, and it's also the nature of the media. We hop, skip, and jump. So this is what I'm doing in the book, is giving this history that we need to understand to get this puzzle. And not only that, the vocabulary, the leaders, the difference between the different countries. Because we're so mystified by this region. And once you get these basic concepts down and understand what has happened there, I think it becomes the puzzle solved, or a lot of it is.
You say the media play a major role in the misconceptions?
Oh, very much. Very much. I mean, even for instance, I just came in from Japan, actually. And when the Gaza situation was being reported, I thought with a lot of the media, you could not tell that the Gazans were in a box, that they could not escape even if they wanted to. And you didn't see the history between, we heard about the rockets that had gone into Israel, but we hadn't heard about some of the military incursions that Israel had done in Gaza. There's a lot of grays in the story, and it was very much being portrayed in black and white. I don't think that does us any good to have this telescopic view.
But, you know, the press does have a real problem. Whenever there is criticism of either side, I know I get, on this show, I get deluged with emails from people telling me that I'm biased. And since I've been biased on both sides over the years because of, at least according to those emails, I feel that I'm okay. But I understand why people might feel pressured at times. On the other hand, why do you think that we get this perception that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is the all-powerful leader of Iran when he isn't? He doesn't come close.
Well, under the Bush administration particularly, we like to have enemies. We like to have enemies in general, but Bush really liked to have a horned, serpent-tailed evildoer, you know, to point fingers at. So, and Israel, too, because Iran has posed a threat to Israel. Israel's very worried, Israel being the only country in the Middle East that does have nuclear weapons, that if Iran has nuclear weapons, that they're going to come over there. So what's interesting, though, that while we have been demonizing, I call him Ami, and Iran, and being very worried about this, that the U.S., under the Bush administration, has been peddling nuclear reactors to pretty much every other country in the region while saying that Iran's nuclear program was such a threat.
And what we've heard more about is the fact that the Russians have been providing nuclear programs.
Right. I think that what we're going to see is a new a checkerboard Cold War action coming into the Middle East. I mean, they already have a base going in Syria, and they have with, you know, Iran. They're also starting to sell to Egypt, our ally Egypt. So Russia's going to come more into the picture, and also with natural gas. They're trying to start an OPEC of natural gas with Qatar, which is one of the big people that have natural gas resources.
So we're going to see a return to some kind of Cold War power politics game that we saw in the past, the United States and Russia again?
Yeah, hopefully not. I hope Obama defuses this. I think that is what was happening with George and everything else, not to get into that field, but yes, there is a very big possibility that it will play out in the Middle East because of energy.
You write that the United States is turning the Persian Gulf into an armed fortress. How are we doing that?
Well, we have a lot of military bases. I don't think people have any understanding of how many military bases we have there. It's a little under 36. And we know we have them in Iraq and at Kuwait, but it's all through the Persian Gulf. So we have our 5th Fleet over at Bahrain. We have our aircraft carriers over at UAE. That's where Cheney would come in and yell in the direction of Iran. We have a central command in Qatar. So we have – what we're doing is actually protecting our trade route. So we're protecting our oil. But – so one of the reasons we do this is exactly to protect the oil. Another reason is the Middle East is our biggest arms client. We like – to get the billions out that we put in into oil, we'd like to get it out in the form of arms. So we're heavily pushing. So when we have a lot of deals going there too. So it's been thought that it behooves our economy to push arms there.
And I'm sure if Americans were even aware of this, they would think that's a good idea. But how does it play out in the Middle East?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's go back to the time of the Shah. You know, the Shah used to be the United States' biggest armed client, and he loved his war ties. And we heavily, heavily armed him, first giving them and then selling them as well. And then in 1979 and the revolution, he gets tossed and Islamic government comes in, and they have all these arms that very, very, very sophisticated arms that we had sold them. So, you know, it was Carter at that time, and they were actually considering just, you know, asking Iran to give those weapons back, guys. You know, so this is naive. I think that we're arming the world thinking that whoever's our friend is going to remain in power, and also they're going to remain our friend.
Well, those weapons didn't help Iran all that much in the war with Iraq.
Yeah, well, that was sort of a draw there. You know, it went on for 8 years. Maybe it wouldn't have gone on. Over a million people died. It was quite a messy situation.
So we had also armed Iraq at that point.
Right.
My guess is Melissa Rossi, whose latest book is What Every American Should Know About the Middle East. It's published by Plume. You write that some of the biggest misconceptions about the Middle East involve the treatment of women. Do you think that Americans focus more on the most extreme nations when they're thinking about what's going on in this region?
Yes, exactly, Leonard. Saudi Arabia, I think, is what, when we think of the Middle East, we see the women that have to be veiled and they can't vote and they can't drive and they pretty much have very, very few rights. That is true in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a very strict, rigid religion in place there, Wahhabism, that a lot of other Muslims find threatening, actually, because it tries to make people live in the 7th century, as they did during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. So a lot of other Muslims don't like this, and Wahhabis do not recognize other Muslims as being valid. So we have this idea, this very strict religion and this treatment of women as being all throughout the Middle East. In fact, most women don't have to veil. They're getting into political office. They can drive. Most of them can vote.
On the other hand, we still see similar kinds of things in Iran, in Yemen, and there's a growing conservatism in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Muslim Brotherhood.
In fact, there are people who will argue that despite our concerns about despotism in the area, if there were votes allowed, we would wind up seeing more of the conservative groups like Hamas elected.
That's exactly. You know, it was a little bit naive for us. I mean, democracy works for us. We like the voting system. We think that's important. But when we go and inflict this idea on other countries in the Middle East right now, you are going to see the people that are the most motivated to get people out to vote are the radicals, the Islamists that want to put a theocracy in place. So yes, I don't think it's a real good idea to go around and demand that monarchies hold elections, because they're going to get in their parliaments, they're going to get the Islamists in there.
So we support somebody like Mubarak, who is an awful dictator?
Yeah, we do. And actually, this is one of the things, you know, our biggest financial aid in the world historically has gone to Israel and Egypt, giving them their free arms every year, $1 billion as a result of the 1979 Camp David Agreement. And it keeps Mubarak in place. So Mubarak every year is like winning, I don't know, with 99% of the vote. And sometimes he goes down to 98. But every time there's an election, so you can tell right there, it's sort of stinky. So yes, our arms keep Mubarak in place. And our arms also enable Israel. And so when Israel does things, people get mad at the U.S. And I'm not saying that Israel doesn't have a right to do things, so let's not even go there. But when they do, it does reflect on the U.S. because of these arms gifts every year.
Well, the New York Times reported the other day that many Israelis see this latest incursion into Gaza as having had little positive effect, even though they supported it at the time for obvious reasons, because missiles were being dropped on Israel. But if it didn't wind up having any real positive effect, then in the end, what can be done in that area?
I think this is where I hope Obama can do some things. I think you have to bring the parties to the table realistically. I mean, Hamas has proven a huge threat to Israel, especially previously. It wasn't these rockets. A lot of these rockets were homemade, number one. A lot of them weren't even being fired by Hamas. It was Islamic Jihad, who hates Hamas, who has everything in there. It's in there, behooves them to mess up everything that Hamas does. So in the case of that situation, you see that Hamas is being pinned for doing things that it wasn't necessarily doing. What could have been done? I think they should have sat down at the table. I think they should have extended the ceasefire. I think you cannot have the situation of Gaza going on because it's a box. They're walled in there right now.
Well, I guess the Israelis were upset that Hamas wasn't stopping the rockets in the territory that they controlled.
Right.
But let's get back to that whole business about conservatism. The alternative is something like Dubai, where people are saying that social values have been liberalized because of business concerns. But is Dubai any more representative than Saudi Arabia?
You know, it's the people in the UAE are – the ones I talked to were really quite happy with the system because they feel, you know, they can go in and sit down one-to-one with their king. You know, I don't think we can do that around here. And they get allotments of land when they get married. They seem to be happy with that system. Is it representative? Well, they're making a few more moves and having an advisory council that talks with the king. But they like the king. They like the king's the sheikh. It's Sheikh Mohammed in Dubai. They like the sheikh's ideas quite a lot. So yes, some of these monarchies, here's the irony. In the Middle East, the things that we think are, you know, threatening is absolute monarchies, some of those are the most progressive. While you have the republics, like you were just talking about, Mubarak in Egypt and in Syria and some of these other republics, they're actually dictatorships. So it's everything is turned sort of upside down in the Middle East.
But, and you describe Saudi Arabia as a country with a split personality.
Oh, it definitely. And it goes back to, you know, when it was formed, actually, it was formed with a military leader, Ibn Saud, and with a religious leader, this Wahhab, Muhammad Wahhab. So he's the one that we were talking about, the religion that they want people to live in the 7th century. So when they stitched together all these tribal areas and this territory, when they put together Saudi Arabia, they split it up. So the Sauds, the royals, would be in charge of like the economy, and which ultimately became oil, while the religious would be in charge of the media, the judiciary, the schools, the religious police. So this was before there was oil. But the minute they found oil, it sort of changed the picture, because when you have oil, you have to modernize. You had to bring in outsiders, infidels, Westerners. So this created this real fissure in Saudi Arabia that continues today. And there are often calls to overthrow the monarchy because they're not seen as living the style that they're supposed to by the religious establishment.
You describe Syria as a divided nation, but in a different way.
Well, it's strange because Syria, you know, we talk about the Shia crescent. The leadership of Syria is actually Shia, and while the majority of the population is Sunni. It's a little bit of a mafia type leadership there, and they.
But the Shia have not allied themselves with Iran, although they have cooperated at times.
Oh yeah, they're allies. They're allies. I mean, the leadership, you know. But the thing is, the people don't particularly like that their leaders are Shia. You know, Syria was really behind the times. It sucked off of Lebanon because, and this goes back to history, which I get into in the book. But you know, the French came in after World War I and hacked off Syria's most important beachfront property and the most beautiful that they loved, and they called it Lebanon, and they put Christians as the highest power group there. Syria's never gotten over it. So this is why you see, I mean, only recently did they recognize Lebanon had diplomatic rights.
And you say not just France, but Winston Churchill was a major problem in the history of this area.
Yeah, he was
the much-loved Winston Churchill.
Yes, and in 1913, it goes back to a decision he made, which was to change the fuel of the warships. And when he changed from coal to oil, it shifted the weight of the world, and every other navy followed, and suddenly this is what we see, these countries getting divided and rich areas being made poor areas being made rich, and agreements being made to behoove the British and French.
Now, we've talked a lot about the problems in Israel and Palestine as being between Hamas and the Israelis, but can there be real peace in the region without the cooperation of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Assad in Syria?
I think you have got to bring in all the parties. I mean,
wasn't Barack Obama criticized for talking about having talks without any preconditions?
Well, I'm sure he will continue to be criticized, but you know what? I think it's a good idea. Get the people at the table, because it doesn't matter if we like the powers that be. These are the powers that be. Hezbollah's incredibly powerful. Hamas is powerful. You know, these governments like Syria, powerful. You know, we obviously will back people like Mubarak. You know, Egypt is one of our allies. We need to just get people talking and get the issues. I think we're going to diffuse a lot of anger. And I think actually in his inaugural address, when he talked about ushering a new era of peace in and being more diplomatically inclined, that was a great signal to send out to the Middle East. People are very optimistic now.
The Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni and the new U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday agreed to maintain close cooperation on Iran's nuclear issue. That was reported in Haaretz yesterday. So the situation is going to continue to be complicated. And whatever the United States does, I think, is going to upset people in the Middle East. And whatever people in the Middle East do is going to upset people in the United States.
I think, however, if Obama brings in the parties and pushes this diplomacy, that's going to lessen the ire. I think you got to get all the parties to the table.
Melissa Rossi's latest book is called What Every American Should Know About the Middle East. It's published by Plume, 450 pages, and
packed with names, vocabulary, the stuff you need to know to understand what's going on there.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Leonard.